You're listening to the Arsenal for Democracy, forging and preparing a new generation for leadership. Now, here's your host from Newark, Delaware, Bill Humphrey.
From 91.3 FM WVUD and WVUD HD1 Newark in the great state of Delaware, I'm Bill Humphrey, and thanks for listening. I'm coming to you this February 18th, 2013, from the University of Delaware. Ahead this hour, guest commentator Rachel beams in from Idaho to talk with me about women's rights in America in 2013, gas taxes, immigration reform, and environmental policy. All this and more just ahead on Arsenal for Democracy. Arsenal for Democracy is usually recorded in studio every Monday afternoon and is available for download on Monday nights at billhumphreyresearch.com/radio and from iTunes and other locations. We air the show locally on 91.3 FM and stream it from WVUD.org on Wednesdays at 6 p.m. Eastern. Email us at afdradio@gmail.com or call and leave a message with your views and questions at 347-688-6676. This is the Arsenal for Democracy. You're listening to Arsenal for Democracy. I'm Bill Humphrey, and joining me this week is special guest commentator Rachel, calling in from Idaho. Rachel, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Bill. Thanks for having me.
You've been listening to the show for a long time, and we've been trying to get you on, but this is the first opportunity that we had. So why don't we jump right in and get to some of these stories that have been particularly bothering me in the past week, and I'm guessing that some of them have probably been bothering you as well. The first story that I wanted to look at was kind of updating people on the situation of some of these more extreme anti-choice Republican legislators, their push to restrict abortion rights across the country. Last year, there was a big controversy because the state of Virginia, some of the extreme legislators were pushing this bill that was going to make it mandatory for people to have a much more invasive ultrasound procedure. That didn't go over very well, and it made a lot of headlines, and a lot of the headlines made a lot of people uncomfortable, and that when that type of thing happens, usually it gets shot down. However, Think Progress was reporting this past week, Tara Culp Ressler wrote a piece on headlined "How Republicans Quietly Mandate Transvaginal Probes When They Think No One's Paying Attention." And so basically what they've come up with now in a variety of other states, Michigan, Kentucky, Arkansas, North Dakota, some of these other places, is to get around the controversy that the state of Virginia faced. They've essentially been instead saying creating artificial situations where you have to get the transvaginal ultrasound procedure because that's the only technological option that works to meet the requirements stipulated by the law. So they don't put it in the exact wording. They just make these workarounds, these artificial scenarios that kind of mandate that by default because it's the only option that satisfies the legal requirements there. The Michigan law, for example, says, quote, it doesn't mention those probes, but it does stipulate that the mandatory ultrasounds need to use the most modern equipment available and provide the most visibly clear image of the gross anatomical development of the fetus and the most audible fetal heartbeat. And so that essentially de facto requires the use of such probes as opposed to the non-invasive ultrasounds. In Kentucky, there's some mandatory waiting periods being added in and counseling and that sort of thing. And then they would require it for they were a little bit more blunt about requiring it for the early pregnancies. But that was, again, a situation of that it had to be done within a certain number of weeks. And you can't actually use the non-invasive kind until 12 weeks. So they just made it so that that this had to happen and so on and so forth in these other states. Just kind of working around to come up with a more politically palatable way of pushing through these awful policies. So, Rachel, I wanted to get your thoughts on kind of this push overall and kind of the nefarious, sneaky way that they're doing it this year.
Well, talking from an Idaho perspective, I just read an article that Well, last year, one of our state senators, Senator Chuck Winder, tried to push one of these transvaginal ultrasound bills through the legislature. And I just heard that although he won't be trying to do it this year, he had several co-sponsors on that bill. So it might sneak its way into the Idaho legislature again this session.
How does it make you feel, like, seeing these sort of pushes? Like, what's your thoughts on whether or not these should be happening? It seems like, we've talked about it before on the show, does not seem to be very popular with the constituency it's being targeted at.
And no, Idaho is a very personal responsibility, personal rights sort of state. We do kind of tend libertarian, and so any talk of regulation tends to get people pretty angry, but I think he was up for re-election this past election cycle, and he did win handily despite his efforts. But it really wasn't very popular. It didn't go over very well. There was lots of demonstrations against it. So I would hope that our GOP learned their lesson and won't try to reintroduce it.
Now, one of the controversial catchphrases of the past year that people, particularly on the left and the pro-choice side and the Democrats, have been tossing out is the war on women. And I think that on this show, we've generally advocated that that is probably an accurate descriptor. But of course, a lot of the pushback coming from the right and the pro-life side of this. Do you see this as part of a, broader pattern now that we're, 40 years on from the Roe v. Wade decision? Is this, an assault on your rights, on your sort of equal status as a person in the United States?
Absolutely. A lot of the language that they use, it seems to imply that we don't know our own bodies, our decisions are based on ignorance or a lack of facts. And so they're saying you have to hear the fetal heartbeat, you have to see the fetus, as if we don't know what's going on in our own bodies. So it's very paternalistic, it's very patronizing. And I and a lot of other women I know, just it's angrifying, if that's a word.
Okay, well, now to move to the flip side, something a more positive development, of course, this is being fought tooth and nail by the same groups, is that the same author at Think Progress also reported last week that the headline was "Teen Birth Rates Plunge to Record Low as Adolescents Now Have Better Access to Birth Control." And so this was, the big peak of a lot of these quote-unquote social ills, teen pregnancy, homicides, other violent crimes, things like that. A lot of that stuff peaked around 91, 92, and then has been pretty steadily declining since then. But a lot of it, the declines have actually happened in the past few years. And so one of these ones that's been in decline is apparently it has now hit a record low of teen births in the United States. And they're down now 50% since 1991, according to the National Center for Health Statistics. But the study itself wasn't actually finding that fewer teens were engaging in sexual activities. What it actually was just looking at was whether or not these births were happening. And now we know that there's been this push to restrict abortion rights. So basically, if it's not more abortions and it's not fewer teens engaging in these activities, the third course that it almost certainly is, in order for there to be such a big statistical change, is that teens have better access to birth control and better information about the options available to them. And these changes have been, something that's been pushed by the Obama administration and Kathleen Sebelius's Department of Health and Human Services, expanding access to some of these kids and making sure that they are better informed over the Bush administration's preference of abstinence-only education. And we've talked plenty of times on the show before about how there's been, eliminating the co-pays on birth control, that has helped a lot of women because it's been very expensive. And they are also there are some other changes, like they're saying that they don't have to do pelvic exams, I think, or that doctors don't. They're not required by federal guidelines to provide those for teens before prescribing them. with birth control. So the access is better. There's also been, we've talked plenty of times on the show about accessibility of Plan B and other options that, you know, prevent pregnancy from occurring, you know, if they didn't take the proper precautions. Still some ways to go on making sure that this is out there. Another big change is that the article here mentions that the CDC has been pushing longer acting methods like IUDs and things like that that would be better than trying to, you know, make sure that teens are remembering to, you know, take something every day or, you know, handle each situation appropriately. So there have been steps taken. Are you seeing this as kind of important progress? What are your thoughts on this shift that we've seen compared to, say, the Bush administration policies?
Oh, I definitely see it as progress. And I wish that they, like, Plan B and, well, it is over-the-counter, but I wish it was over-the-counter for teens younger than 16 as well. And also making birth control available over-the-counter is something that the article stated that the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists have recommended, which it appears that most countries around the world already allow for that. And it's so simple. More birth control equals fewer unintended pregnancies. But because there is that culture of shame around sex in our society, we aren't progressing in that area like we should.
Now, one of the things that we've talked about on quite a few episodes of the show is just the how expensive, and this came up especially with the Rush Limbaugh-Sandra Fluke controversy, how expensive a lot of these birth control methods are. And obviously, that's going to be still a bit of a problem for a lot of teens that's going to be an access issue is the cost. But, you know, some of the corporations and the insurance companies, and even now corporations that don't even have religious ties, some of them resisting very heavily on making sure that the insurance plans provide free birth control options and other contraceptive options for female employees. You know, could you offer some comments and thoughts on that particular issue, the sort of cost barrier and some of the resistance we're seeing there?
Well, I think now that the Affordable Care Act has required that health insurers provide birth control for free, it will strike down some of that cost barriers. Like me personally, my current insurance plan only provided financial help for oral contraceptives only, ignoring the many other useful contraceptive types such as the NuvaRing or the patch or the shot or even IUDs. It would have provided no help whatsoever if I chose to have an IUD inserted. And now that is going away, I think women can choose for themselves their most effective birth control. Like if they know themselves and know that they probably won't remember to take a pill every day, they can use something that is more user-friendly. Idiot-proof, I suppose.
Right. And I definitely think that this is an improvement, but, you know, we still have a long way to go, and we still need to make sure that these regulations are being actually implemented and enforced and that they are going to hold up. Fortunately, you know, the president's reelection means that we aren't going to see these reversed over the next 4 years, but we need to make sure that they also hold up after he leaves office, no matter who comes into office after this president. Another thing that we've been keeping an eye on, you know, for a long time on this show, but also just in the last couple weeks on this front of, you know, protecting women and guaranteeing them the, you know, the ability to be equal humans with equal rights in this country and, you know, that they're safe from some of the issues that have been a problem in the past. The Violence Against Women Act, originally 1994, we talked about this before on the show, had expired in 2011, and the Congress has been pushing, especially the Democrats have been pushing for reauthorization of this ever since it expired, and really struggling against some of the Senate Republicans trying to block it, as well as the House Republican majorities. And the major sticking point here, which is this is really sad, is that a lot of the Republicans seem very opposed to some of the provisions to protect American Indian women on reservations in particular, who are unfortunately high percentage of victims of domestic violence and other forms of violence against women, assaults and rapes. And I was looking at some of the publications by, like, the Native American Times, some press releases from the National American Indian Congress, these groups, the advocacy groups pushing for these provisions to be included, and the Republicans strongly objecting to that on, I would argue, pretty offensive grounds. It's kind of amazing that they can get away with these kind of positions in this day and age, just openly saying it without even coming up with some, you know, convenient cover story. But essentially, the issue is that in addition to some of the domestic violence problems on the reservations, we've had some significant problems of, I guess you call them the Anglos in the communities nearby the reservations, basically going onto reservation territory, committing these crimes, and then hopping back off the reservation where they take advantage of these jurisdictional loopholes that the reservation police can only act within the reservation, and that the surrounding communities, police forces and sheriff's forces can only act outside the reservation. And they basically, a lot of times there's this loophole that they can commit a crime on the reservation and then get away with it by getting off of the reservation. And so this was a loophole that they were trying to close, among other protections for these populations. And some of the Republicans were basically holding up the entire legislation because of these added protections, which, as I said, just seems mind-bogglingly offensive to me that they could even, you know, think about something like that. Now, Senator Kirsten Gillibrand has been one of the big people pushing this legislation, as has been Senator Chris Coons from Delaware, continuing the legacy of Joe Biden, who was one of the original, the primary original author of this in the 1990s as Delaware's United States Senator. And it did actually pass through the Senate finally. I think it had passed and then died in the House at the end, toward the end of last year. But it did pass through the Senate this time, probably in no small part due to the fact that there are more women in the U.S. Senate than ever before at one time in U.S. history. And she is now, you know, trying to round up more support on the House side. But it's going to be a tough fight unless Speaker Boehner really gets behind this. And so far, that has not been the case. Which, you know, again, it seems to be very puzzling. The other issue that some of the Republicans bring up is that it's going to cost about $659 million over the next 5 years, which seems like more than fair price to pay. You know, I think it's well worth the money. You can't possibly value the lives of these women less than a fairly small amount of Washington level pocket change. And you know, that if we're protecting women, that's going to help with making stronger families and ensuring their economic security, which in turn helps everyone. So I don't see that that's an argument against this. You know, this is a very serious problem. I think one of the statistics that the White House gave out was something like three women, I think, are killed every day in either domestic violence incidents or other forms of violence against women. One of the other people, and this was one reason that we wanted to get you in on this story, one of the other people who's been actively pushing this, and he's one of the few Republican men who not only didn't vote against it, but is actually one of the sponsors, Senator Mike Crapo from Idaho, has been pushing this pretty enthusiastically. His colleague from Idaho, Jim Risch, voted against it. So I was wondering if you could comment kind of a little bit on that. I'm not really familiar with his motivations there. Crapo, I should specify. And I was wondering if you could comment more specifically, or more broadly rather, on the progress of the Violence Against Women Act in general.
Well, Senator Crapo has been a longtime proponent for the Violence Against Women Act. It's one of his passions in the Senate, and he made some remarks about how in Idaho, high school student dating violence has dropped by 5% from 2007 to 2011. However, since January 1st of this year, 4 deaths in Idaho have occurred from the result of domestic violence. So he is obviously very passionate about it. He wants to address domestic issues and the importance of preventing violence against women. And it's really sad to realize that Senator Risch doesn't share his views and doesn't feel the same way about valuing women in our state.
I think it's really interesting that for all the talk of family values, a lot of these guys in this U.S. Senate really did not come through for strengthening families and keeping women safe in these situations. To me, I don't understand what the resistance is here. There's certainly no logic behind it. I mean, obviously, I think you could make some pretty strong sociological arguments that ascribing some motivations to these, or at least some deep down motivations in terms of the value that they may place on women. But you know, I'm always hesitant to speculate on some of that. I mean, as Joe Biden is always saying, that one of the things he was taught early on in the U.S. Senate was, you know, you can question someone's policy views, but you want to be very careful and try not to question their motives, because they probably think that they have good motives and they're just, you know, executing or acting upon them poorly. But yeah, it's such a shame that this should be a no-brainer. It hasn't been an issue any of the previous times that it's come up for reauthorization. I don't know what the problem is this time. Did you have any thoughts in particular on the hang-up regarding American Indian women and specialized protections for them?
We do have a quite significant Native population in Idaho, and as we all know, there is a lot more violence, a lot more problems on reservations that I just don't see how we can address that, and how we can't value Native and get them justice that they deserve when non-Natives commit violent acts against them.
Well, another topic that I wanted to touch on that's related to everything that we've covered so far is a more broad look at issues of gender equality in the United States. The New York Times had a long feature by Stephanie Kuntz that was published over the weekend that was looking at the 50th anniversary of Betty Friedan's international bestseller, *The Feminine Mystique*, and that came out in the 1960s, and a lot, you know, it was a big motivator for the women's movement, the rise of the first, you know, couple waves of late 20th century feminism, the stalled push for the Equal Rights Amendment, things like that. And the article was looking at how, for a long time, there was quite a bit of progress from the late 70s into the early 90s about making sure that women had the opportunity to leave the house, to enter the workforce, that they were given some very basic protections like unpaid family medical leave after giving birth. Again, most industrialized nations would guarantee paid leave, and it was seen in the early 1990s when it was passed as sort of a very basic stepping stone that would lead to something else. Unfortunately, it kind of just stalled in the 90s, and it never went further than that. So at least, you know, women are guaranteed a job when they get back, but the, you know, they're not getting paid over and it's a very short period of just 12 weeks. The dads are not necessarily guaranteed any protections of being able to be with their families during that period. And that's sort of on the policy side, but then sort of on the sociological side, that the percentage of stay-at-home moms, I think, started increasing again after it had dropped to a low period, and that a lot of those were not necessarily by choice, that those women, some of them were seeking to re-enter the workforce, were having difficulty doing so, that sort of thing. I was wondering, you know, kind of just your general perspectives on this, you know, looking back over the 50 years, where we've come, are we backsliding? Is this a temporary thing, maybe because of the kind of the economic stall of the middle class over the past decade between the two recessions that we had? You know, what are your thoughts on where gender equality stands now and where we could hopefully see it going?
I think we have a lot of work to do. especially with regards to the expense of childcare, many other industrialized nations provide either subsidized or free healthcare, childcare, and that seems to remove a lot of the economic obstacles to returning to the workforce. At the same time, women are often paid less than men for the equivalent jobs, and so there isn't that option of choosing who gets to stay home and who gets to go to work, because men are quite often the primary breadwinners for the household. And so it just doesn't make economic sense for fathers to stay at home, even if that's what they would like to do. It just doesn't make the economic sense. So I think if we can put men and women on an equal playing field economically, I think there would be more fathers choosing to stay home and allowing women to pursue their careers.
Now, one of the discussion points that comes up in this article in the New York Times was essentially they were talking to some degree about women who would like to reenter the workforce and were having difficulties doing so. But one of the other points that was raised was, you know, was the push or the goal to get women into the workforce or to give them the option to be in the workforce if they wanted to? Do maybe some of these women prefer to stay home and do, you know, do this other effectively full-time job that, you know, it's not being compensated or valued by our economy or society properly, but in real terms, a very very valuable work at home, either with childcare or general household tasks and things like that. Should the emphasis be on getting women into the workforce or giving them the option to be in the workforce?
I think the emphasis should be on getting them in the workforce. There is still an unspoken culture of not promoting women in the workforce because there is that, oh, will she or won't she choose to have kids? And she might choose to stay home after she has those kids, so there's really no point on to promote her or move her up the chain of command. So I think if we give women the option to stay in the workforce to advance their careers, I think a lot more of them would choose to stay in the workforce even after having children, because they have advanced their careers enough. They're not entry level. They're not being held back by their gender.
I think that's definitely an interesting perspective that I don't think was really addressed by that article. But I think, you know, that we definitely should be having some type of national conversation on how we value these things, whether or not there are opportunities for advancement beyond those sort of lower tiers in the workforce. I think that's probably a very good point, that if women definitely were guaranteed the potential to keep moving up, then a lot of them, and tied into that, if there were also better ways of paying for childcare and that sort of thing, that they would probably be more inclined to re-enter the workforce very, you know, not that long after having children and, you know, live the full and equal lives that men get to participate in without, you know, anybody questioning it or making a big deal out of it, that the assumption is that that's going to be the case for men, whereas it's not assumed that way for women. I don't know. This country doesn't seem to be terribly good at having national conversations, so who knows if that's actually going to happen.
Right. Remember the furor when Yahoo hired that new CEO when she was heavily pregnant. There was that concern that, oh, she's about to have a child. Will she be committed to working at Yahoo and improving it? It was really kind of shocking to see just how anti-feminist people still are, and anti-pregnancy, I guess.
I think Yahoo has a lot more problems than whether or not their CEO is expecting a baby.
Right, exactly.
All right. Well, let's just take a little bit of a transition here, so we can go into some other stories from the domestic policy scene. But we'll be right back after this here on Arsenal for Democracy. I'm Bill Humphrey. Welcome back to Arsenal for Democracy. Joining me from Idaho today is our guest commentator, Rachel. I wanted to talk about a kind of issue that definitely affects everyone in pretty much every state of the union. Even Hawaii has an interstate highway, so it affects them too. The federal gas tax hasn't been raised in quite a long time. I think it was the early or mid-90s that it was last raised. And due to inflation and rising gas prices, a lot of that has lot less significant or lot less real value now than it did at the time, and people are tending to buy less gas and therefore are paying less of a tax in overall terms. A lot of states and federal governments, a lot of state governments and the federal government depend on these gasoline taxes to pay for their expenses for maintaining roads and bridges and things like that. And they are now coming up with shortages because the gas tax isn't covering as much of those expenses as it was before. And it seems to be basically politically impossible to raise the gas tax. Now, this is something that's been debated in a lot of state governments, in the federal government, in the policymaking circles. The environmental community in particular would definitely usually advocate for a very big increase in the gas tax, not even close to what it would be in Europe, which has deterred a lot of driving, but that it that it should be raised significantly, because I think it's like 18 cents a gallon or something like that right now, and that's just not very much in actual terms. Yeah, 18.4 cents per gallon, and that was last raised in 1997. So a lot of things have happened since then, and a lot of these governments are trying to figure out how to literally patch holes in the roads when they've got these holes in their budgets due to the gas taxes not going up. And then, you know, some states have gas taxes on top of the federal gas taxes as well. And this was sort of brought to a head this week by a very kind of out there proposal by very conservative Virginia Governor Bob McDonnell, who was saying in Virginia that he thought that they should get rid of all of the gas taxes. They would still keep the diesel taxes, but that they should get rid of all the gas taxes, have an annual fee on cars that run on alternative fuels. That, of course, has been another pressure, is that as more and more cars are either fuel efficient or electric or alternative fueled, they're not paying gas taxes or not as much of gas taxes. And then he was saying make up for the complete elimination of the gas tax by putting a sales tax, or they already have a sales tax, so basically raising the sales tax. Now, a lot of people objected to this, particular libertarians objected to this because the premise of the gas tax was that it was, you know, a special tax that was going to pay for transportation and infrastructure costs. And now, if you kind of divorce the two, they felt like that now makes it, you know, more of a problem because people don't see that it's, you know, what it's going to pay for. The counter argument that's being made here by McDonnell and some of the other folks who were kind of intrigued by this idea because it sort of came out of nowhere, it seemed like, was that they were saying, well, the fact is the gas tax hasn't been raised in so long, and these budget problems have been so severe that a lot of people are just seeing crumbling roads and bridges anyway, and they have no idea what the gas tax is going to pay for anyway. So you might as well save them some money at the pump but charge them somewhere else and tell them we're raising this particular tax to pay for actually finally fixing these problems. So this is certainly going to be an ongoing source of debate, I think. But especially in response to the environmentalists' argument is that a lot of those arguments are being made by people who live in more urbanized areas, usually places with much better public transportation systems. And the reason that it's so politically infeasible is not so much the outright opposition to taxes, is that this would be, much like a sales tax in general, very regressive, but it would be in particular not equally regressive by class like a sales tax generally is. It would be geographically regressive, so that some people in very rural areas or in very sprawling areas would be hit much harder by the increased gas taxes than by people who have good access to public transportation. And, you know, if they live in some place like New York City, may never pay a gas tax in their life because they don't have a car and they don't, that's not an issue and, you know, they're never going to pay a gas tax directly. Now, Rachel, I'm not sure exactly where you are in Idaho, but Idaho's a pretty good example of someplace that's generally quite rural and spread out, and I assume you have to do a lot of driving around there. What are your thoughts on kind of this situation and balancing that need for revenues versus the equal distribution?
Well, Idaho has actually a quite significant gas tax. We tax it 25 cents per gallon for both gasoline and diesel, which I'm looking at a state-by-state rundown. It actually looks pretty high. I am personally in one of the more urban areas. I'm in the Boise metropolitan area, but we don't have a very good public transportation system, so it is very necessary to drive. There just isn't the infrastructure for public transportation there. So I see where Governor McDonald's coming from, but I can't agree with a sales tax funding for infrastructure. His opponent said, it is really regressive, and it does somewhat punish even non-drivers, which I can't really agree with.
So you think that it would be better and fairer to have, like the libertarians were arguing, the Cato Institute type, saying that the idea behind it should remain that you're paying for a service that you use?
Correct. And I agree with tying the tax to inflation so that funding doesn't stagnate and wither away as the years progress. I've also I'm a bicyclist. I'm not a driver. And I have heard about requiring registration for bicycles to kind of help fund that as drivership goes down due to gas prices, filling in that gap for bicycles, replacing cars, which I have noticed has ridership has gone up significantly. So as a bicyclist myself, I would not be opposed to paying for the roads in a minor way.
Now, do you think that, you know, the constant thing we hear is, oh, it's politically infeasible to raise the gas tax. But you're saying, you know, that the state of Idaho already has a much higher gas tax than the baseline federal gas tax. Is it really that the case that there would be this huge kind of libertarian anti-tax backlash in a lot of these rural states, I guess more than you usually get anyway? Or do people fundamentally understand that they, you know, if they want to use these services, that they have to be maintained, and that if you want to maintain these things, then you're going to have to, you know, pony up the money?
I think it's kind of an invisible tax because you just see the gas prices on the billboard, and you don't really see that breakdown of where the price is coming from. So I think since it is kind of an invisible tax, I think if you raised it, people would gripe, but I think they would just pony up and pay the gas prices.
I think that's an interesting point, that they'd probably, like, it would blow over pretty quickly and they'd probably stop noticing it because they can't track it. Whereas if you raise the sales tax, that's on every single receipt that, like, oh, there's a certain percentage higher or whatever.
Right.
Huh. Well, that's an interesting thought. Another proposal, according to this New York Times article, that was where I was getting most of this from, by John Schwartz, published last week. One of the other sort of proposals being tested is that in Oregon and Washington, right there next to you in Idaho, they're saying, what about if we charge users based on the number of miles they drive? So if you had it in a state with an easy pass system or something like that, like a lot of the northeastern states have now, that's pretty easy to track on the main toll highways because you already are tracking people's progress. If they have, like, for example, New Jersey, you basically can't get on a toll highway without having a transponder. So there's already a way of tracking you. But a lot of states don't have that. The other thing was, you know, a lot of cars now have built-in GPS systems, or people have other forms of GPS systems, and you could track it that way. Now, some people, of course, are objecting, saying, you know, this is some sort of Big Brother type thing, and that everyone's, you know, everyone's going to be tracked. I feel like that would probably cause way more of a, you know, paranoid libertarian backlash in a lot of parts of the country than having, you know, just raising the gas tax or something like that. I mean, what are your thoughts on kind of a more GPS-based tracking system for charging people based on the mileage, not just the fact that they use the highways?
I can already imagine the letters to the editor in the local paper talking about how they're going to track us and know our every move. We are a very libertarian state, and I can't see that going over very well in Idaho, at least.
All right. Well, let's turn now to another controversial thing that sparks quite a few letters to the editor, which is immigration reform. So last week and the week before, I talked about on the show some of the comprehensive immigration reform proposals coming out of Congress by the Gang of Eight that we – you know, that was a bipartisan group working on this led by Marco Rubio. And I initially expressed some surprise that I feel like the White House may have been kind of blindsided by Rubio's proposal coming out of the gate a lot faster than expected. And they probably weren't super willing to let him lead. But as Newt Gingrich kindly put it today on I guess it was yesterday on one of the morning talk shows, congressional Republicans personally really don't like President Obama, just on a very visceral level, and so they probably aren't going to approve anything that actually has his name on it. I mean, they weren't able to deny him re-election, but they still feel like they can deny him policy victories. So if the president actually wants to have accomplishments, he may need to sit back and let Congress do some of the work. I think there's a risk there that it ends up like healthcare, where he hung back for too long. But then what happened over the weekend was that, and this is what sparked a lot of this discussion on the Sunday talk circuit, was that a plan got, quote, leaked from some department or agency that that the White House had asked them to look into some of the details on some of the possible options on some of these immigration reform plans, which indicated that they were working on their own plan. And of course, you know, Marco Rubio very upset about that. A lot of the Republicans working on this kind of immediately threw a tantrum and started stomping around and, you know, saying that they were working on this first and that it was very unproductive and unhelpful. Now, the White House's response was, well, we're just working on this in case that plan falls apart. We need to have a backup option. I don't know how legitimate that actually is. I would question whether or not this actually got leaked for real or whether or not it was intentionally leaked as a way of telling them that they needed to kick it into gear and get moving in with this congressional plan if they were going to go forward with it at all. The most controversial part of this, quote, leak part, which I guess is why some people thought maybe it was an accidental leak, is that they had allegedly it's a generous plan for some of the undocumented immigrants in that it allows them a path to citizenship that would start 8 years from now. I don't even think that they would become citizens in 8 years. It's that they wouldn't get to start until 8 years from now or until right after it had been all the other legal people waiting in line had already been taken care of, which won't happen within 8 years anyway. So it's effectively 8 years. But that seems like really long to me. So I'm not super sure why everyone's so worked up about that. I mean, it seems like if you're going to have to pay a fine and wait 8 years, that's a pretty significant punishment for not following the legal processes. I think the other interesting thing that I liked is that they look like they're working on, this was part of what they were researching, was actually getting a more streamlined system together for speeding up the legal immigration process, which has been one of my things that I've been kind of passionate about on the immigration front for many years now, which is why are people coming here undocumented? It's usually because they can't get here legally. The New York Times reported yesterday, this boggles my mind, apparently, if you try to come from Mexico through the legal processes, it takes 16 years from the time you apply to the time they give you a green card, which is just, that's insane. 16 years. I mean, like, that's such a long portion of someone's lifetime to be waiting. It's obvious why so many people are coming here undocumented, because they can't wait that long. And so if we're going to get serious about this, we need to speed up the legal immigration process. And that way we make sure that everyone's, you know, who's supposed to be coming here isn't sneaking through because they've committed crimes or, you know, those kind of things. That you know, we tie in the border enforcement, et cetera. Rachel, any thoughts in particular on this, you know, the competing immigration plans here and, you know, what maybe you're hoping to see come out of all of this?
Well, I think most people don't realize just how arduous a journey it is to legal citizenship. And I think if more people knew, just for example, like the Mexicans who have to wait 16 years to receive a green card, I think most people just don't know about that and how expensive it is. So I would like to see some of those obstacles removed. And like the article mentioned, remove some numerical caps, those quotas. I think if we get rid of those, it would just streamline the process, expedite the process, just make it overall easier for immigrants who want to be here legally to achieve that.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. I think it's just the whole system's really messed up, and if I feel like the solution, if you can't stop immigration and human migration from happening. It's been something that's just always been a feature of our society. You know, short of going into North Korean style lockdown, you just can't stop it. The solution to illegal immigration, undocumented immigrants coming, is to improve the legal immigration processes so that you can keep an eye on people coming in, make sure that they're approved, that sort of thing, because they will find a way to get through whether you like it or not. So you should make it the most efficient and secure process possible to reduce any, you know, potential downsides or threats to that situation. Did you by any chance get an opportunity to catch the State of the Union? I missed part of it, but I heard some parts of it.
I did watch it. I was blogging at the same time, so I might have missed some portions of it. But I did, for the most part, pay attention.
Any overall thoughts on the State of the Union? You know, how you thought maybe it tied into the inaugural address or anything?
I didn't get a chance to see the inaugural address. But overall, I thought President Obama laid out very clearly his hopes for the next 4 years. And I think he provided a lot of solutions that should be enacted if he could get the legislative branch in line with his views, which is going to be quite the challenge.
Now, he apparently took a fairly strong stand on issues like climate change, which the Republican House majority is not on board with at all, but saying that he would come up with as many ways within the executive branch to act on some of this. Kind of dire, actually. I thought that it was less, here are some executive branch proposals on climate change in terms of reducing the threat of climate change. It was more like, if we assume that climate change is going to happen and we can't stop it, which I guess may or may not be true, is probably happening, whether or not the Republicans in Congress get on board with that anytime soon. That he was saying that if we take that as a given that it's going to happen, here are the XYZ risks and damages that come with that. Let's get our coastal communities' emergency preparedness plans improved. Let's figure out what we need to do to like put up better seawalls and other coastal protections. You know, how are we going to deal with crop failures, things like that? It was sort of the apocalyptic inconvenient truth style way of handling climate change, which, you know, to be totally honest, is probably the way to go at this point, because if the Republicans aren't going to do anything on it, you know, he can't do it all by himself, and we can't do it without the United States taking a leading role on this worldwide. So he's saying let's act to be prepared for it, which, you know, that's obviously a pretty sad resignation to have to come to, but better than nothing, I suppose. However, In addition to some substantive things like continuing to improve car efficiency requirements, things like that, and some usual renewable energies, improved fuels, blah, blah, blah. The part that really bothered me is in the middle of him saying all this stuff about how we needed to, you know, do all this research, improve our technology, you know, clean energy, blah, 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 starts talking about how we need to get more oil and gas imports into the country and things like that, and that we need to have natural gas burn cleaner and all that. These things are bad for climate change, and they make it worse. Like, I don't understand how you can put those in the same sentence. If you're going to make an energy independence speech or part of your speech, then okay, fine. I can see how getting more fossil fuels from Canada and the United States is better for, you know, our security or whatever. But that's not the same as climate security and combating climate change. Did you have any kind of thoughts on that, his sort of ongoing, quote, all of the above stuff?
I have a major problem with his all of the above plan. All of his talk about alternative energies is fine and good, and I agree with it wholeheartedly. But then when he does mention oil reserves and fracking and tapping into our natural gas, it makes me see red, because we can't move forward if we're still focusing on fossil fuels and trying to use those up. It's going to hold us back from improving our alternative technologies.
Absolutely. And of course the major outcome of the specific part about bringing in more sources within North America is, of course, that people are wondering, is this signaling that he's going to approve the Keystone XL pipeline from Canada? Of course, I've talked about this previously on the show. A lot of the jobs figures being associated with this have been grossly exaggerated, the claims there about how many jobs this was going to bring in. The Washington Post last year had done some fact-checking and found that even according to the company's own statements, that it was at most going to create about 6,000 or 7,000 jobs in the U.S. that were going to be pretty short-term, 1 to 2 year jobs. In some cases, there were allegations that some of the numbers were being inflated because basically, you know, they would work on the pipeline in one town in one state, and then they would move further down to work on the next section of the pipeline, and that would be counted as a second job for the same person doing the same thing. I think, you know, these jobs claims that are why the unions are backing it are wildly exaggerated. I think it's the wrong direction to take it in. I've also talked a lot about on the show previously about how this pipeline is being sent directly across the Ogallala water aquifer. For those of us on the East Coast, we don't worry as much about our water resources most of the time. For those of you in the Midwest and the Mountain West, water is a pretty big deal. And the Ogallala Aquifer is one of the hugest supplies of fresh water and drinking water for people in the entire Midwest, for water for their crops, for the bread bowl of the nation. And basically, we know that no matter how safe they try to make these pipelines, there will be leaks. It's inevitable. And if you put it over the top of an aquifer, that water does not wash away. That oil or gas goes down into, you know, through the ground, goes into that aquifer. And not only is it big, but the reason it's so big is because it's a 10,000 year aquifer. That means that some of the water has been in there for 10,000 years. We're already using it up faster than it's being replaced, because it's obviously, for something that big and that old, it's a pretty slow moving process. But if we now poison that water supply, that poisons that huge underground reservoir of water, and it permanently destroys it, because it's not going to be filtered out for, you know, some thousands and thousands of years. I don't understand how it's even a consideration. And I think, there's been bipartisan agreement in the state of Nebraska from both Republicans and Democrats that this plan is lunacy to put it through. But of course, Canada's been pushing really hard to get the State Department to approve this plan, regardless of environmental costs or jobs merits or anything, because it is going to create a lot of jobs in Canada. And of course, the unions, some of them are international and have a lot of members who are going to get jobs in Canada because of this. And, you know, so I think that raises some serious concerns. Did you have any thoughts on that particular project as we close out your segment here?
Well, as the climate scientist James Hansen said, if this Keystone Pipeline was allowed to be built, it would be game over for the climate. And I don't think maintaining good diplomatic ties with Canada or 6,000 jobs is worth it to jeopardize our climate in so drastically.
Also, the New York Times kept on talking about how they thought that Canada and the Harper conservative government might, you know, retaliate or whatever. And honestly, it's Canada. So to be perfectly honest, bring it on because I do not care. Like, you guys aren't actually going to get mad at us. So, and you'll probably apologize while doing it. So anyway, you know, I just it's and it's such a shame too that Canada is kind of taking this, you know, position because again, they should have the similar concerns, and it's because it's such a conservative government, and Harper is from the Alberta oil fields regions himself, so he has personal political investment in this. I don't know if he has financial investment, but political certainly. And it's just like, you know, come on, we need to make progress on climate issues and clean energy. Not keep going backward in this old direction that is really frankly worn out at this point. Well, thank you so much for joining me on the show this week, Rachel. I really appreciate you taking the time to fill in today on this President's Day or Washington's birthday observed holiday.
Thank you so much. It was a pleasure.
Well, that's all for this week. Thanks for listening to Arsenal for Democracy for February 18th, 2013. The show is usually recorded at the University of Delaware Perkins Center every Monday and is available for download from billhumphreyresearch.com/radio on Monday nights. You can also hear a repeat of it on 91.3 FM WVUD and WVUD HD1 Newark or at WVUD.org every Wednesday night at 6 p.m. Eastern. Special thanks to my voiceover man Justin and my guest commentator Rachel, who joined us this week from Idaho. From the WVUD studios in Newark, Delaware, I'm Bill Humphrey, and I approve this message. Good night.